The Best of Times Radio Hour, live on 101.7 FM and 710 Kiel, a show dedicated to seniors and boomers in Northwest Louisiana. Here's your host, Gary Kaligas.
Good morning, radio listeners. I'm Gary Kaligas, the publisher of The Best of Times, the only magazine and radio show for mature adults in Northwest Louisiana. I do thank you for tuning into our show today and also thanking those who might be listening via the internet at www.710kiel.com. Also thanking those who might be listening via the Kiel application on their Apple or Android devices. We do thank AARP Louisiana Neighbors, Tenant Country of Shreveport, your Dodge, Chrysler, Ram, and Jeep dealer for being the exclusive sponsors of this radio show to provide you with beneficial information each and every Saturday morning. In just a few minutes, we're going to learn why our medicines cost so much these days. So stay to the show for some very interesting information for you and your loved ones. It is Saturday, May the 11th, and we are broadcasting our show from the studios of News Radio 710 Kiel, a Town Square media station here in Shreveport, Louisiana. However, today's show is not live, and it has been pre-recorded, so we will be unable to accept call-in questions and comments from our loyal radio listeners. Be sure to pick up the current May-June 2024 issue of The Best of Times at one of our 270 distribution locations. We thank you for the many compliments about our magazine. We do appreciate hearing from you. Remember, if you're unable to find a printed copy at one of our distribution locations, you can always visit our popular website at www.thebestoftimesnews.com to view both current and past issues of our magazine. In addition, you can view and download the 2024 Silver Pages Senior Resource Directory. In addition, you can listen to previously broadcast shows here on the Best of Times Radio Hour. In addition, you can also listen to our radio shows on Apple Podcasts, where you load in the name of the Best of Times Radio Hour, and it will pull up some 900 different shows of the past many, many years. The 2024 Silver Pages Senior Resource Directory is available, but very few printed copies are still at some of our distribution locations. If you want a printed copy, again, they're very limited, but you might want to visit the Cattle Council on Aging or Bossier Council on Aging. Of course, as I mentioned, it's always on our popular website to view it and download it. In addition, it is on our app via Maxter on the Best of Times app as well as Silver Pages app. Each and every month, the Best of Times sends out a TBT newsletter via email eBlast to over 73,000 email addresses of seniors and boomers in Caddo and Bossier parishes. It provides them with a link to the current issue to view it online. Also, a link to our Silver Pages Senior Resource Directory. In addition, there are many more educational articles and information that is not included in our current issue of The Best of Times. There's several discount coupons as well as the contents and lots of additional news that you can use regarding entertainment, events, and other happenings in the area. Join the many thousands who are receiving this free newsletter via their email address. To subscribe free of charge, just visit the Best of Times website at www.thebestoftimesnews.com to subscribe. You just simply give us your email address and you'll start receiving our newsletter each and every month. Great news, our friends at Ernest Arlene's has brought back the Best of Times special dinner each and every Thursday from 4:30 p.m. to closing with fabulous meals at a highly discounted price. It is highly recommended due to the popularity of this Thursday night special to make advance reservations by calling 318-226-1325. Again, that's 318-226-1325. We'll be right back with more information, but now a word from our sponsors and advertisers who do make this radio show possible. You're listening to the Best of Times Radio Hour here on News Radio 710 Kiel, proudly presented by AARP Louisiana and A-Bears Tenant Country of Shreveport, your Dodge, Chrysler, Ram, and Jeep dealer.
The Best of Times Radio Hour will be right back on 101.7 FM and 710 Kiel. Now Now back to the Best of Times Radio Hour on 101.7 FM at 710 Kiel.
Welcome back to our show, the Best of Times Radio Hour, proudly presented by AARP Louisiana and A-Bears, Town and Country of Shreveport, your Dodge, Chrysler, Ram, and Jeep dealer. I'm Gary Kaligas, and I thank you for taking time to listen to our radio show today. Joining me on my show as a special guest is Dr. Rivie Aaron, a professor at the University of Houston and director of the Bayer Healthcare Business Institute. I've asked him to come on our show because he provided me with advanced information about, he's going to explain to us why our medicines are costing so much. So thank you, Dr. Aaron, for joining our show today.
Thank you for having me on, Gary.
So tell our listeners a little bit about your background.
My research is at the intersection of technology, economics, and healthcare. I'm a professor of healthcare strategy technology in the C.T. Bauer School of Business at the University of Houston. I also have an appointment with the medical school at the University of Houston. I study problems that have to do with how technology and economic strategies are having an impact on healthcare outcomes in large population. That also means how drug makers price their products, how device makers price their products, how global supply chains of drugs. One of the things that's not well understood is pharmaceutical drugs, once they come off label, are rarely manufactured in the U.S. They're manufactured in other destinations and then shipped to U.S. So those supply chains have a very big impact on the cost of drugs. And the cost of drugs then has an impact on the price that we as consumers pay. So I study all of these factors, and I look at large data sets and look for patterns.
And do you report to other agencies like our government, et cetera? Do you provide reports and background information to them, or are you provided to congressmen and senators when they're – I think they recently had a Senate hearing, right?
Correct. So my research is widely published in research journals, and it is cited by policymakers, by other researchers who report in. I do not have commercial relationships with any drug firm or anything. So my research is completely academic research funded by grants, not from pharmaceutical firms.
Okay, that's an interesting caveat. You know, the sad thing, and when you sent me some information, I did not know this. The CDC reported that 9 million Americans skipped at least some of their meds in 2021 because they could not afford them. That's so sad. And
yes.
That is remarkable. And the other thing is the pricing gap that was discussed at that Senate hearing where the senators grilled the four chief pharmaceutical CEOs about, you know, the pricing gap and other issues. But didn't they also the comparison of our prices in comparison to Europe and other parts of the world are the same medicines?
Indeed. So if you look at a quick 20,000 feet scan at the price differences that the United States and compare them with the OECD countries. American consumers, if you look at price across all drugs, on an average, American consumers pay as much as 2.78 times.
Wow.
That's 178% higher in comparison to countries that are similarly economically developed. I don't mean Nigeria and Indonesia. I mean Western Europe and Northwestern Europe. And the price of brand drugs were about 3.22 times. That's 222% higher on an average. Now, if you control for adjustments of estimated U.S. rebates, those rebates may come from volume discounts that pharmaceutical companies offer hospitals, special pricing deals with insurance companies, and Medicare, Medicaid negotiated prices.
Right.
But there is no question that Americans are paying something between 180 to 240% higher.
Well,
it's an enormous difference, and that explains why those prices explain why many American consumers especially those that are uninsured and underinsured, sometimes skip drug dosages simply because they can't afford it.
Well, some of my pharmaceutical friends tell me that the reason being that the pharmaceutical drug that's administered and given to individuals in the United States is a better quality than it is possibly in Europe, in Asia, et cetera. Is that a valid statement?
Some of that is true. However, the contribution of better quality control, we have what are called statistical quality control and testing regimes. Some of that is certainly true, that in certain drug categories, especially when they are manufactured overseas, India and China are the two large drug manufacturing destinations. Many American drug sources test the quality more rigorously as compared to some other rich countries, especially if you compare that with the UAE, rich countries outside of Europe, United Arab Emirates. American quality sourcing is higher. At best, that would add to between 2.6 to 7% of the price differential, not more than 10%, if I do a quick back-of-the-envelope check.
Oh, wow. The other thing that I was told is because we have so much federal regulations with the FDA and all the other entities that whenever a pharmaceutical company has to develops a particular drug, it has to go through all the hoops and hurdles, and it costs them more time and effort. And in Europe and those other places, they don't have to go through all those rigmarole accreditation.
That is also generally true. So pharmaceutical companies, when they bring a new drug to the market, what the consumer sees, the buyer of the drug, what the consumer sees is actually like an iceberg. It's a small, shiny piece of ice above the water. There is an enormous mass of ice below the water that we don't see. If you take that metaphor and extend it, when research starts, we typically call it the bench-to-bedside research cycle. Bench is when it's actually some researcher's idea and they are still doing experiments in a lab. It's a lab bench. And bedside is eventually that becomes a bottle of pill on somebody's bedstand next to his bed.
Okay.
So if you take the bench-to-bedside cycle, there are many, many regulatory constraints that FDA imposes on pharmaceutical companies. And those regulatory constraints have to be met before a new drug, remember, this is important, a new drug is released. And so, yes, to some extent, that adds to the cost of drug development. And that is very true. But we do need those procedures because you don't want fly-by-night drug manufacturers to release molecules. Typically, a new drug sometimes is referred in the industry as a molecule. You don't want to release a new drug with insufficient testing, which has devastating side effects once
True.
After about a year of taking. You don't want all kinds of bad things to happen to patients.
But what I want to ask you is, when a particular new drug is invented by researchers in America and they might give that to another pharmaceutical company or sell it to another one in Europe, but sometimes those individual companies in Europe get the approval and start giving it to patients before it's even given anyone in the United States. And I've heard that happen several times.
Yes. Occasionally that happens, less frequently now than it used to, say, about 20 years ago, because the standards in the rest of the world are beginning to catch up with those of the United States. But what you say is certainly true. But there is another phenomenon to take into account, which economically is a much more significant phenomenon. American consumers subsidize the rest of the world when
Wow.
it comes to drug development.
How do they subsidize it?
This is the interesting part. So if you take a very important drug, such as, say, the statins, Lipitor is a great example. Lipitor came off label some time ago. But Lipitor is a hugely important drug. And if you take an important drug like Lipitor, billions of dollars are spent in developing that drug, testing it from bench to bedside. The initial idea, testing multiple variants of it, having a molecule that seems to work, and then doing phase one animal test, phase one test. Phase two and phase three are scale volume tests. Enormous number of different sites and patients have to be empaneled, and then they have to be rigorously randomly allocated in a controlled drug trial test. A placebo versus this has to be checked, and all of that has to be documented, submitted to FDA, and then FDA approval process, you know, multiple referrals, et cetera. Finally, the drug is approved. That is expensive. Okay. Now think of what happens when that drug crosses the Atlantic and goes into Europe. European consumers pay a government negotiated price for that drug. That, as I told you earlier, American prices can be as high as 3.22 times. That's a 222% higher than the European price for new drugs. It's particularly important for new complex molecules. What happens? European countries are paying a much lower amount. The fixed cost of drug development has been swallowed by the American corporation that developed the drug and brought it to market. For them to recoup the expenses and to get a reasonable return on their investment, they're going to have to price it high somewhere. Remember, even successful drugs have an uncontested market territory that they can harvest for about 4 to 5 years. By 4 to 5 years, there'll be other drugs that do similar things that are on the market. So if you think of Viagra coming into the market, there is Cialis that's competing with Viagra. There are varieties of different drugs that metformin came off label quite a while ago for diabetes, but there are variants of those that are competing in the market. And there are, for most drug categories, there are variants. Even the two blockbuster drugs, the semaglutides, that were the Danish company that released them, very soon there will be a family of semaglutide drugs with similar impact, targeting different endocrinal and physiological functions that will be in the market, which means the drug company has a window of 4 to 5 years of high-margin pricing. To recoup the cost and to bring a reasonable return on investment. Where do they get that high margin from? From the United States. Because Germany and France and the National Health Service in Britain negotiate prices. And you cannot market your drug in Germany or France and say, I will bypass government negotiated prices. They'll say, you simply cannot market it here if you bypass our prices. So the big variable contribution margin on a drug comes from the United States. The United States consumers are doing a huge favor to the rest of the world by paying very high prices for drugs whose benefit is commonly reaped by all users later. Does that make sense, Gary? Do you understand where I'm going with this?
Yes, I understand. Well, it's sad in a way. You know, we have to be.
It is.
And they don't appreciate. Some of them don't appreciate that. I'm sure they're not appreciative of it.
A lot of them don't because it's widely not known. People don't. It's not easy to explain the dynamics of fixed cost versus variable cost and variable cost margin and the payback period and the harvest window. These are ideas that get lost in the popular discourse. So when politicians make policy, sometimes people's eyes glaze over when you give these details. You know, you need to illustrate this with specific, sharp examples. What would happen if American consumers were to pay the same price as the rest of the world, or at least the developed OECD countries? Oh. The margins on many drugs would fall. Many rare disease drugs will not be developed or tested. You see, pharmaceutical companies do something called cross subsidies. I mean, if your listeners are aware of this, I won't go into depth, but do you want me to tell you a little bit about how they cross subsidize drugs in their portfolio?
Well, let's hold that thought. We're going to come right back
sure.
and you can talk about
sure.
that. We'll be right back with more information, but now a word from our sponsors and advertisers who make this radio show possible. You're listening to the Best of Times Radio Hour here on News Radio 710 Keel, proudly presented by AARP Louisiana Neighbors, Town and Country of Shreveport, your Dodge, Chrysler, Ram, and Jeep dealer.
The Best of Times Radio Hour will be right back on 101.7 FM and 710 Keel. Now back to the Best of Times Radio Hour on 101.7 FM at 710 Keel.
Welcome back to our show, the Best of Times Radio Hour, proudly presented by AARP Louisiana Neighbors, Town and Country of Shreveport, your Dodge, Chrysler, Ram, and Jeep dealer. Joining me on my show today is a special guest, is Dr. Ravi Aaron, who is the professor at the University of Houston and also the director of the Bayer Healthcare Business Institute. I'm asking him to come on our show to explain to us why our medicines in the United States are costing so much. So thank you again, Dr. Aaron, for joining our show today.
It's a pleasure, Gary.
So he's been discussing some of the details about pricing and medicine pricing. So you were, before our end of our first segment, you were talking about the crossover, right?
Yes, the cross subsidies that pharmaceutical companies use to develop drugs for rare diseases, drugs for which that target a particular kind of a disease in a particular population group, which is not a mass drug that you can sell across all consumer categories. So what happens with these drugs is that they don't have a large base over which you can defray the cost and bring a reasonable return. So one of the things that you have to do when you have drugs like these is you've got to take the money that you make on a larger portfolio of drugs and use that to pay for the cost of developing these drugs.
Oh, didn't know that.
That's cross-subsidizing. And once the drug is successful, because there's a lot of uncertainty if that molecule is going to succeed, sometimes in rare drug categories, one out of five experiments can actually go to phase two and phase three drug trials. So if there's a general drop in margin prices, there is less money available for trying out these new drug categories. They become unprofitable. There's less money available for cross-subsidy. So what happens is when the United States customers are paying so much higher comparatively to the developed world, the rest of the developed world, the big margins that company make on the U.S. customers sometimes helps to defray the cost of developing drugs that have great benefit to world over. But that benefit is shared widely, but a disproportionate burden of the cost of development comes from the higher margins that American consumers pay.
For other drug prices, for the other drugs. So it's a crossover. I never knew that. That's quite interesting. One little sidetrack that somebody wanted me to ask you. So these pharmaceutical companies come up with this specific brand name drug, and then how many years later do they have to become generic, and therefore it's decreased, but it's supposed to be the same drug? Is that true?
Yes. So it's called coming off label. And different drug categories have negotiated, but generally within 20 to 25 years, they come off label.
How many years?
But keep something in mind.
25? How many years?
Well, it depends on the drug class, the country, the agreement between the country. It's a variety of factors. It can go anything from 10 to 25 years, depending on the drug class.
Wow, I didn't know it was that long. Whoa, okay.
But keep something in mind. The fact that the drug is still on label does not mean that they have unrestricted, unbridled power to price. Here's why. Let us say you come up with a drug for diabetes that has multiple benefits, like it helps you fight obesity, it helps you lower your weight, and in the process, it makes it easier to manage type 2 diabetes. You may ask, the drug may come off the label in 15 years, but within 3 to 4 years, there will be a category of drugs that do the same thing. And within about 5 years, the drug prices will fall because they're now competing against multiple drugs that give the same category of benefits through other physiological mechanisms. There are drugs that similarly target the endocrinal system, provide the same set of benefits, but using a different set of physiological mechanisms. So even though the drug is not off-label, it's got another 10-year honeymoon period, nonetheless, what happens is that the price has begun to drop because there are multiple competing products in the market. So that honeymoon period, the economic honeymoon when the drug can be priced high, typically goes to a period of 4 or 5 years. And after that, there are so many competitors that the market does its magic and the prices start falling. Again, the market does its magic subject to national boundaries and national regulatory regimes. So, yes, the price will drop much more for Western Europe and Northwestern Europe than it is for the United States.
Amazing. So tell our listeners a little bit about, I don't know this answer either. I want you to discuss it. So when a drug is developed by a pharmaceutical company and they go through all their testing, do they know the price? It's after the end of all their FDA approvals, or do they know an initial price that they're going to charge consumers and insurance companies, et cetera? Where's the price coming in?
It's a great question. The pricing of a new drug is a very complex problem. When the drug is on the bench, that is when lab trials are going on, when they're testing, when they're formulating the molecules, when they're testing on live systems for side effects, et cetera, at best, the price is a hazy estimate made by the business arm of that pharmaceutical. They may say, well, here's how they do it. Literally a back of the envelope chicken scratch on a piece of paper. They'll say, well, let's try this out. So they're going to say, about 20 million people world over are impacted. About 15 million of them have this pricing power. We could probably price a single dose of this drug at about $8. And we are in the next, we assume that the lifespan for about 3 years, we won't have a competitor if everything succeeds. And that means we are probably going to make about if this drug is a big success, we'll make something between $1.5 and $3 billion in the first 5 years. Net of all costs, it will bring a gross margin of about 65% on this drug. Remember, the gross margins have to be high because many experiments fail. They will never see the light of day.
Oh.
That is a complete write-off. You get zero from those experiments. If you stop those experiments, you will stop drug development. So they say this is at stage zero. This is basically an idea in the business arm of that pharmaceutical company.
So that's a good
point. That's
a good point about, I never thought of that until you mentioned it, that some drugs that are invented by the medical engineers and medical specialists, but after testing it, they fail or they don't do what they're supposed to initially thought they would do, right?
Yes. In fact, failure is the majority norm. For most new drugs and for diseases that are still difficult to treat, the overriding concern is to make that molecule work safely with minimal side effects. With those constraints and objectives imposed, more initial bench lab testing drugs fail. They don't even go to phase 2 or phase 3 drug trials. They simply found hazardous or they don't deliver the benefits, or the side effects to main benefits is not large enough to proceed with the drug. So those experiments are aborted at various stages. All of that is a full write-off. Now, what happens is, in stage 2, when the drug clears the bench testing and FDA says, I'll give you an initial approval to do phase 2, it's cleared phase 1 and initial approval to do phase 2, drug trials, phase 2 and phase 3 drug trials, somebody will get an idea based on phase 1, small group targeted tests in the United States or in Europe in those countries, and say, well, we think the market size is going to be not 200 million, but maybe just 100 million. And they will readjust that price window.
Wow.
After phase two and phase three, a lot of drug trials happen in countries in India, China, Vietnam, Bangladesh, in Africa, in the east coast of Africa. There are a lot of drug trials which go on, some in Latin America. They'll get a better idea of the success and the side effects. They'll say, well, it's likely it's more targeted. The benefits are not as widespread as we expected. There are many mediating and moderating conditions, physiological conditions that reduce the target population. We're probably looking at about 10 million people. It's not a very large category. We have to adjust the price upwards to get that gross margin of about 60% and a net margin of about 30-35% on this success drug. So it goes through stages of pricing, Gary. And sometimes the prices are, in some cases, the estimated price is adjusted downwards because the drug is more successful than you think, and it's going to have a larger market. And you'll say, this is where in economics what we call the price elasticity of demand comes in. You price it too high, a lot of commercial insurances will not pay, a lot of doctors may be reluctant to prescribe those drugs. And if you price it too low, you leave money lying on the table, especially because your opportunity window may just be 3 to 4 years before other drugs come on the market with similar benefits. So the pricing is very, very complex. By the way, prices also change after a drug goes to market. They really? Take it to market at a certain price. There is wide pushback. People say, we're just not going to pay for this. And then they lower the price because, well, they overpriced it. They made a mistake. They overpriced it. And all of these things happen.
Well, I'm still amazed, being a senior citizen myself. I have yet to heard anybody say that, I really don't want to get this medicine because it costs $500 for 10 pills. Do they really? Can you really complain through your pharmacy, through the pharmaceutical company? I think that's an interesting aspect, especially in America now.
The complaints actually come from four sources, as you correctly pointed out. It's a very astute question that you're asking, can you really complain? And it actually comes from four sources. First, patients say, this is so important for my living and my well-being, and this is priced out of reach. How fair is this? My taxpayer dollars probably paid for some of this.
Correct.
So that is a direct complaint source. Second, it comes from the physician. The physician may say, look, you have overpriced yourself. He may give a feedback to the pharma. You overpriced yourself. Most of my patients to whom I'd like to prescribe this are not able to afford this. The third may come from the commercial insurance companies. And here again, United States plays a very important role. The big commercial insurance companies, the Aetna, IBC, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, all of these plans, these are widespread in the U.S., not so much in Britain. The National Health Service covers the broad population, and if you want better care, quicker care, you buy top-up insurance. And in Switzerland, again, there is a basic insurance that everybody gets, and people that want better, faster care will buy a top-up insurance. Top-up is a private insurance, same as Britain. You do not have widespread population dependent on private commercial insurance in an advanced country as it is in the United States. So the big commercial insurance companies will also push back. And finally, you have public forums that collect these concerns and give it to policymakers who will then call the companies. I think recently the CEOs to the four large drug companies had to testify before Congress, and they were asked, why is it that that drug costs are so much higher in the United States? So these kinds of hearings are held. They are not so held so often in Europe. Occasionally they are held. There is some song and dance made about some drug prices, but it's much more prevalent in the United States than in the other developed countries.
Well, hold that thought. We'll be right back with more information. But now a word from our sponsors and advertisers who make this radio show possible. You're listening to the Best of Times Radio Hour here on News Radio 710 Keel, proudly presented by AARP Louisiana and Ebers, Town and Country of Shreveport, your Dodge, Chrysler, Ram, and Jeep dealer.
The Best of Times Radio Hour will be right back on 101.7 FM and 710 Keel. Now back to the Best of Times Radio Hour on 101.7 FM at 710 Keel.
Welcome back to our show, the Best of Times Radio Hour, proudly presented by AARP Louisiana Neighbors, Denning Country of Shreveport, your Dodge, Chrysler, Ram, and Jeep dealer. Joining me on my show today as a special guest is Dr. Ravi Aaron, who is a professor at the University of Houston and the director of the Bayer Healthcare Business Institute. And he's on our show to explain to us why our medicines are costing so much. So again, Dr. Aaron, thank you for being on our show today. You've given us some great information, and we're going to continue this segment. So first of all, we're discussing all these. Will the costs even get worse, you think, in coming years?
In some cases, yes. In many cases, no. I think drug prices will continue to fall. The Inflation Reduction Act had multiple provisions in it. Insulin, which is exorbitantly expensive for many senior citizens and for people that suffer from, especially senior citizens that suffer from diabetes, insulin prices are beginning to fall, and their negotiated prices are going to be the norm very soon, if not already. So you're definitely going to see a fall in several categories of drug prices. But there will be some categories of drug prices where the price may go up, paradoxically enough, because the cross-subsidy, the money left in the pocket of pharmaceutical companies to cross-subsidize a rare drug, there is less money left as a result of reduction in the prices of popular drugs. When that happens, they're going to look at earlier, if there were 10 marginal drugs that a company was willing to risk saying, you know what, these are important diseases, we need to have a cure for them, and therefore they're experimenting on drugs, that 10 may get reduced to 7 or 6 because some drugs will become what economists call inframarginal. Financially, what it means is under current conditions, it is simply not worth our while experimenting with those drugs.
Okay.
So those prices of those rare drugs may actually go up because companies will say, you know what, we don't have as much money to take from a portfolio of drugs and to develop and to take this to the market because our margins have shrunk. We're going to have to price this higher. So some rare category drugs, the prices may actually go up. I think here the government can play a very, very important role, which gets lost in all the discussion about price regulation. Targeted micro-subsidies, where government says, this is a very rare form of, let's take an example. The cornea drying up, corneal problems, there are a variety of reasons why the cornea dries up and it becomes first translucent and then doesn't let in enough light, eventually resulting in blindness. We'll take this as an example. There could be some rare genetic factors that cause this. And that's probably going to be about 0.5% of the population. The government can come in and say, we will subsidize the bench efforts of these diseases. In other words, your doctors in Johns Hopkins, your doctors in, let's say, MD Anderson in Baylor. So these people, when you start a research on this rare disease, which may not be economically viable for the company to take to the market, we'll subsidize that research. That is what I call micro-targeting subsidies. Not a broad subsidy, but a very specific case where you write a grant to NIH, the National Institutes of Health, and say, this is a rare category of drugs that will never come to market under the current economic regime unless you subsidize the early stage of this until we can take it to the market.
So is this available? Is this available now, Doc? Is this available now to the for the government and to the pharmaceutical company? What you're talking
about? Some of this happens even now. Yes.
It is available.
To answer your question, Gary, that is true. If some of this happens now, you can write grants for drug development to a variety of funding agencies, including NIH. But what is going to be needed is an expert panel of scientists, especially scientists that do lab work in medicine, who can evaluate a drug category and say, yes, this is promising. And then they now then kick the ball to a bunch of economists who will say, yes, this is so small that it will become an inframarginal drug. That means the benefits of this will not justify taking it to the market. Let's offer a micro-targeted subsidy for lab, for experiments, for the experimental costs, both material and human costs, up to phase one. If it succeeds in small group experiments in phase one, the company can then, you throw the pass to the company, they can catch the ball and run with it, and then they take it to phase two, phase three, mass drug trials.
Wow.
So that kind of micro-targeted can help bring rare drugs to the market.
So going back, I think you need to explain to our listeners out there a little bit. It was in the news a long time ago, but you haven't heard too much about it. The Inflation Reduction Act and how it may impact Americans. So who gets the benefit of this new law?
So largely, the Inflation Reduction Act has a bunch of provisions. Let's take a few very important high-level ones. It caps the price of insulin at $1.35 a month for Medicare enrollees. For older Americans, out-of-pocket spending is capped at $2,000 a year starting 2025.
Right.
It also authorized Medicare to negotiate a drug price directly for 10 very important prescription drugs. And that list will start expanding over time. That has been built into the Inflation Reduction Act. So branded generics, it's a slightly different categories, but eventually some of the branded generics will also come under this, but not immediately. But unbranded drugs, they constitute the bulk of drugs that patients consume. So if my aunt, who's 80 years old, is taking Lipitor, she's no longer taking Lipitor. She's taking the generic drug, the atorvastatin. So these drug prices are going to get negotiated, capped, and also on the demand side. So we talked about the supply side. On the demand side, how much people actually pay. Insulin prices capped at $35. Out-of-pocket spending for senior citizens capped at a max of $2,000 a year. So these things are very beneficial.
They will be. They will be. But the other question about that is, I'm a little prejudiced. I'm a Medicare person, but what about people that are not Medicare? Did this Inflation Reduction Act help people that are non-Medicare, non-Medicaid?
This is an excellent question, and this is often missed in policy debates. It's a very, very astute observation. They get hit with two kinds of problems. If you're non-Medicare, Medicaid, first of all, what is called the donut hole, where you have your copay has reached a certain level and you've got to pay out of pocket and make up that level. And you don't get, there isn't enough commercial insurance to help you, and you've not reached that 65-year threshold where you can become a beneficiary of negotiated prices. That's what we call the donut hole. Sort of people who fall in the middle. There is not much help that's going to come. The insulin, $35, is still a great thing. They will benefit from it. The other group is the uninsured and underinsured patients under the age of 65.
Yes, that's what I was going to ask
for. For them, when you say that your copay is capped at $2,000, that's great if you're insured. But if you're 43 years old, you have a heart condition, and you're underinsured, a lot of those benefits will not apply to you. If you're an uninsured worker, if you're 30 years old and you're starting to experience, you're 35 years old and you're beginning to experience early stages of degenerative discs in your lower back, degenerative disc condition in your spine is beginning, starting, and you're about 35 years old, you're a carpenter, you work with your hands and do stuff. Those benefits, most of them will miss this uninsured person. So really, if you want a force multiplier for these benefits, bring the uninsured into some form of an insured umbrella, whether it's the Affordable Care Act or some of the state-sponsored insurance benefit, and then you will see it's a force multiplier. Not only do they get some minimal benefit of being insured, but they also get the benefit of the provisions in the Inflation Reduction Act.
Well, we hope that comes to play pretty soon as well. So in closing, what do you give as a top thing that consumers could do to be able to afford their needed medicines? What's the top number one suggestion?
Well, I'd actually offer two or three suggestions. First is there are a variety of reliable sources on the web where you can research what drug you've been prescribed. And the next step is to look at the prices of those drugs. The idea of a bunch of patients getting into a bus, going across the border to Canada to buy drugs in bulk and come back, a lot of that can be minimized if you research those drugs. When you go to your doctor and your doctor says, oh, is ABC your pharmacy? I can fax your prescription to your pharmacy. You can tell them, yes, doctor, for these three drugs, ABC is my pharmacy. For drug number four, ABC is very expensive. I'd like you to send it to XYZ, when it's nearly 56% cheaper.
Excellent idea.
Or this is a benefit area where I would like you to get involved. Here are two other trends to keep in mind, Gary, which I think on the whole will be very, very beneficial for customers, for American patients. One is, giant retailing firms, specifically as Amazon starts getting into the fulfillment business, they will start bringing in price discipline. Not only will they bring price discipline, they will also bring delivery and logistics. They have been extraordinarily successful in delivering things and in logistics, in reaching the last mile consumer in hard-to-reach places. As Amazon comes into the business, they have very, very deep analytics capability. They analyze the price, the demand per trend. They analyze the hell out of all of these things, which is why they're able to keep the price lid on a variety of products. It's the world's largest e-commerce store, right? So as they get to this, they're going to bring the discipline and the transparency of analytics, and you're going to see a lot more comparable prices. If your local XYZ pharmacy, if you're in Des Moines, Iowa, and your local XYZ pharmacy is charging you 56% higher than Amazon, simply ask your doctor to send the prescription to Amazon. They can do the fulfillment. As companies like Amazon come into this and you're going to have remote fulfillment increasing, you will see a lot more of this happening.
Wow, great. Is it happening now? I did not even know if Amazon does this. I'm an Amazon person, but I don't even remember if they do pharmaceuticals and drugs yet.
They do boost them. They do make offers of doing fulfillment, and as a result, the other companies, they are preemptively, for instance, CVS can say, you can sign up. You don't have to, when your prescription order comes in, you don't have to come all the way to CVS to pick it up. We can actually have it delivered. We'll send you a text message. You say yes,
that's
and
right.
We'll have it delivered at your doorstep.
That's right.
Other companies are beginning to do this because Amazon is ramping up its capabilities for drug delivery and order fulfillment. And yes, very definitely, Amazon is in that business. That has a widespread knock-on effect as the industry starts moving towards these things. The glare of analytics, the relentless glare of comparative shopping will come eventually, sooner rather than later, to drug prices also. That is going to have a disciplinary effect on these local monopolies. Like, you know, you may have somebody in Wisconsin or Wyoming in a rural area. Somebody in Milwaukee, rural area, is being served by a pharmacy in Racine, Milwaukee, which is semi-urban. And that person may be paying a very high price. All those things will go away when you have
universal delivery market and universal consumers.
Well, that's a good thought. I hope it happens. Again, thank you for joining us today. You were quite educational for me, and I know for my many thousands of listeners out there. I appreciate the information and appreciate the solutions. Let's hope that the cost of our medicines decrease, and so more and more people can definitely afford them in this day and age. So thank you again, Doctor, for joining us today on the Best of Times Radio Hour.
Thank you, Gary. This has been a great pleasure, and I think your questions were very, very important, and they actually target some of the most burning issues of the day. It's been a great pleasure. Thank you, Gary.
Thank you a lot. Everyone, I hope you listen to another show next Saturday morning for the news and information that could benefit you or your loved one. Don't forget to pick up your personal copy of The Best of Times at one of our distribution locations. May God bless you and your family. God bless America. Have a great day and a great weekend. Thank you again for listening to our show. I'm Gary Kaligas, wishing you and yours the best of times, both today and every day. Have a great day.